Penguin Random House Audio presents The Cost of Free Land, Jews, Lakota, and an American Inheritance. This is the author, Rebecca Claren. For Jude and for Louis. He, Rabbi Tarfon, used to say, "It is not your duty to finish the work, but neither are you at liberty to neglect it." Pirkei Avot 2:16. Note on terminology. For most of the United States official history, the Ocheti Shakowi people have been called Sioux. This was not a name of the nation's choosing. Their enemies, the Chippewa, referred to them as Naduwesi, meaning enemies or snakes. French traders mispronounced the term and abbreviated it to Sioux. This book is primarily concerned with one of the seven nations that comprise the Osseti Sakowan, the Lakota, of which there are another seven subbands. The Lakota refer to themselves by the name of their dialect, which translates as, quote, "Council of Friends." In an effort not to repeat mistranslations of the past, I have chosen to use that name outside legal or historical references to the Sioux. For the most part, I've followed the advice of Gregory Younging's Elements of Indigenous Style, a guide for writing by and about Indigenous peoples. Many terms used to identify Indigenous people are controversial. Over the course of more than 20 years of reporting on Indigenous communities in the United States, I've met people who call themselves Native, Indian, Indigenous, American Indian, Alaska Native, and Native American. Some individuals use these terms interchangeably, depending on who they're with and where they are. The writer David Trower, who is of Ojibwe and Jewish descent, offers sensible advice. If you are concerned about what to call someone, simply ask them their preference. The terms used in this book are a reflection, whenever possible, of the quoted person's choice. Prologue. 22 years ago, while on a reporting trip to the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, I found myself sitting shotgun in a truck with a man who would later become president of the Oglala Sioux tribe. He was smoking weed. When he offered me some, I declined, hoping to indicate a level of professionalism that, as a reporter visiting an indigenous community for the first time, I certainly couldn't claim. We had driven off a dirt road and were parked at the top of a rise. Before us were green rolling hills and the flat plains beyond. It was gray outside. I later described the day this way, quote, "Thick clouds the color of ash hang low in the sky, and the damp and cold air sinks into my bones like a long depression." A herd of buffalo with their dark brown backs dotted the landscape. Officially, I was there to write an article about how a group of Lakota were defying federal drug laws to grow industrial-grade hemp. More than an effort to build a foothold in a niche market, this was a way for them to wield their sovereignty. Treaties signed with the federal government more than a century earlier established the Lakota as an independent and equal nation that was allowed certain authority within its borders. According to the hemp grower, this meant he and his family could create their own rules about what to grow on their land, even if those rules conflicted with United States law. It is likely that I was wearing jeans and a plain gray t-shirt. Back then, this was more or less my uniform for reporting trips, as I believed that by wearing clothes with limited personality, I could signal to sources that my identity didn't matter. In my bag beside me were a camera, a DAT recorder, and my slim reporter's notebook with the binding at the top. I had one great question prepared, which I had learned from a This American Life comic book about how to be a reporter. My boss had told me to write down every single thing that I saw and heard and smelled, but nonetheless, I failed to record whether the man beside me in the truck smoked a pipe or rolled a joint, or if he seemed very high, or how I felt about any of it. Sitting there in the small cab, the dank cloud of smoke lacing the air between us, I was uncomfortable with the quiet. I had yet to learn how to follow a source's lead. I had yet to learn so many things. In my nervousness, I decided to share something about myself. I told him that my family used to own land in South Dakota, that we'd had a ranch somewhere known as Jew Flats. I told him I had an uncle who everyone called Bronco Lou. I remember thinking this might make him see we had something in common, that this might endear me to him. He was polite, or maybe just stoned, and nodded. His smile was thin in a way I couldn't read. It would take me years to realize what my words would immediately mean to any Lakota citizen. The 9/11 attacks had taken place the week before I visited Pine Ridge. One evening, while I was there, over a paper plate of food that the hemp growers had shared with me at a family gathering, I said something banal about the horror of the recent events in New York. Sitting beside me, a former American Indian Movement activist stared at me, her mouth a flat line, and said, quote, "Now you know what it feels like to be attacked and invaded. It's about time for Americans to understand how that feels." The day before, an Oglala elder had told me, quote, "When I saw those people running through the streets with terror, I was reminded of my ancestors running in fear at Wounded Knee." Even then, I failed to connect certain dots, certain historic realities between her, the Lakota, and myself. All these years later, what stays with me from that reporting trip, what seems now to be the clear central narrative, appeared at the time to be only tangential to the article I was there to write. In 2001, I knew only the major plot points of my family's history in South Dakota. I knew that my great-great-grandparents had 6 children, 3 girls and 3 boys, and that they came to America as part of a wave of Jews who fled Russia and its anti-Semitism at the turn of the 20th century. I knew that they, like many other immigrants at the time, received free land from the federal government, a cool 160 acres that was theirs to keep if they could turn the wild prairie into farmland. I knew their life was hard and strange. The stories that relatives had told me, well-worn from years of retelling, underscored an unfailing tenacity, a specific toughness, as if it were a part of our DNA. One such story went like this. It was cold because it was winter in South Dakota. My great-great-grandmother, Vega Etka Sinikin, sent her 2 youngest daughters, who were as young as 10 and 12 years old, outside, armed with an axe or log, to crack the ice-choked eddy of the creek behind the house. Once they succeeded, Vega Etka went to the creek, stripped, and dunked herself in the freezing water. This was her mikveh, a Jewish ritual bath that religious women take at the end of their menstrual cycle. That my great-aunt and several cousins refer to this story as cute, as in, do you want to hear a cute story, tells you something about the women in my family. Another selection from our greatest hits. When one of the 6 Sinikin children was old enough to pass for an adult, they would write 21 on a small piece of paper and stick it inside their shoe. Then they would walk into the land office and ask to file a homestead claim on their very own 160-acre parcel. The land clerk would look them in the eye and ask if they were of age, and they would swear, without lying, "Yes, sir, I'm over 21. That my family handed down these particular stories, selected from the slush pile of history, leaving other more problematic plot lines behind, is instructive. Because, of course, both the stories we choose to tell and our decision not to tell others create the myth we pass to future generations. I grew up looking at mysterious, never-explained photographs of my relatives posing with indigenous people in South Dakota. In one, my cousin Vivian is at a roadside stand, the Badlands behind her. She is wearing a breastplate, its beads made of bone, over her Peter Pan-collared blouse and pleated skirt. She and the man beside her are wearing matching eagle feather war bonnets. In another sepia-toned photo, my great-great-uncle Jack, his gun holstered over his jacket, shakes hands with a man whose skin is a few shades darker than mine. The man wears full regalia.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?